Good, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of time for rebuttal. Gary Hattelstead, appearing for the state, Your Honor. May it please the court, associate justices, ladies and gentlemen of the assembly today. It's great to have you here. Your Honor, this case began in 2003 when a police officer was dispatched to a local apartment building on a report that Mr. Hubler had improperly touched a child in the swimming pool. The officer responded, spoke with the manager, spoke with the alleged victim momentarily, and then encountered Mr. Hubler, who just happened to be walking on the property. He asked Mr. Hubler to briefly describe what happened, and he basically said, "I love to tickle children." At that point, the officer decided that he would like to interview Mr. Hubler, invited him down to the police station for an interview, and they had an interview. As I pointed out, the interview was tape recorded. Later, Mr. Hubler issued a few incriminating responses, but he denied the mens rea for the crime of lewdness with a child. He subsequently reduced summarized his interview to a police report, and then arrested Mr. Hubler on 2 counts of lewdness with a child. Following the arrest, the Wash County Public Defender's Office was appointed, and his case was assigned to a lady named Carrie Glenn Isom. She began investigating this case, and what she did is she asked for discovery from the state, which included specifically videotapes. She also read a police report authored by Mr. Stagmeyer, who is a detective, a probable cause determination sheet, and a police report that accompanied it. But she did not get these tapes and never did. Meanwhile, she talked to Mr. Hubler 3 times. In each of these instances, he was not terribly responsive or helpful in the interview process. He had a bad attitude, for lack of a better description. He was suicidal and depressed, and periodically, he said he wanted to get this over with, plead guilty, and go to prison. She tried to go over the police reports with him, but he was not responsive to her. He never confessed to her. He denied touching the child with the appropriate or required mens rea. She tried to discuss the significance of this denial with him, and he was not responsive to that. He talked a bit about his experiences in Vietnam, but she did not discern from that a connection between this crime and his experience in Vietnam. Not that he didn't talk about it, but he did not connect this event with it. When asked by the police to explain why he thought he committed these, why he touched children or was touched or touched these children inappropriately, he blamed his father, who he said would molest anything. Meanwhile, as I said before, Mr. Hubler was adamant about pleading guilty, getting it over with, and putting it behind him. According to Ms. Isom, she tried to talk him out of it, explained to him, "We don't have the tapes yet," and tried to stall him, but he did not want to do so. He wanted to get it over with and plead guilty. Meanwhile, she got a psychosexual evaluation, which came back with a diagnosis for mental health issues, including post-traumatic stress disorder, antisocial personality traits, but a low to moderate risk to reoffend. So that was important in the event of a request for probation. Plea negotiations ensued, which included a plea to 1 of the 2 counts, free to argue at sentencing. Then sentencing occurred. He got 1 sentence of life with the possibility of parole. Probation was denied. The rest of the story.
Let me ask, what's our standard of review in this particular type of case?
On historical questions of fact, it would be a deferential standard. And the historical facts in the case aren't in dispute. We did not reveal the tapes. And at relevant points in time, we had them. Exactly when we had the physical tapes is not quite clear, but clearly the police had them. And because the police had them, as you know, that knowledge is imputed to us. The Brady question is reviewed de novo.
Mr. Hallstead, just for the students' benefit and the faculty, Mr. Hubler did plead guilty to 1 count of lewdness, and then the other count was dismissed as part of a plea bargain, is my understanding. If we affirm the decision of Judge Kosach, isn't it true that Mr. Hubler would still face these charges? He just would be able to withdraw his guilty plea, and you'd still be able to prosecute him on the original 2 charges, not just the 1 he pled to. Is that correct?
Correct. The upshot would be his plea would be withdrawn, sentence would be vacated, we go back to square one, right where we were when the plea negotiations ensued. The rest of the procedural history of the case is, very briefly, Mr. Hubler did not file a direct appeal, but he filed something called a request for extraordinary relief in 2004, and that was denied. Intervention was not warranted. He went to federal court with a federal habeas petition alleging essentially all the claims that he pleaded here, and that petition was either dismissed because of the mixed question of exhausted and unexhausted claims. I don't want to get too bogged down in the detail on that. And then he filed his petition here in May of 2006, 3 years after the judgment of conviction was entered, so we made a motion to dismiss that. That came before Judge Kosach, and in his first order he said, all of the claims except the Brady claim are barred. But he wanted to hear the evidence on the Brady claim, and we had that hearing. The hearing lasted a day. The attorney testified in the case, and following the hearing, Judge Kosach entered a very short order. I think it's very deficient in many regards. It has virtually no findings of fact on anything that really matters. And he reached the merits of the Brady claim and concluded that the Brady material that was withheld was material evidence and was outcome-oriented. When I wrote my brief, I critiqued his order because it didn't necessarily describe or discuss the interrogation tape, and heavy weather has been made of that in the petition for in-bank reconsideration because the three-judge panel didn't look at it too carefully either, although they didn't analyze it. So that's why we're here. There's been an in-bank reconsideration motion made following the three-judge panel decision that Judge Kosach aired and reversed. So counsel made the motion for a rehearing in-bank. So that's why you're here. And the court set the case for oral argument. So the question, I mean, there's a number of questions presented in this case. Up to this point, this court has never decided whether or not Brady applies in a plea context. There's plenty of cases out there that say it does, and there's a minority view that says it does not. My view of the situation, and I pointed this out in the written submissions, there's a level of gamesmanship in a pre-plea setting to withhold the good stuff for the defendant. So that should be avoided. That's part of the policy of Brady itself, not to hide the ball. So I think from a policy consideration, specifically the policies that underlie Brady, Brady should apply to a pre-plea context. Where the cases divide is on the subject of exculpatory evidence, that is to say, evidence that gets the defendant off the hook, and impeachment evidence, the courts will draw the line. And the United States Supreme Court in the Ruiz case in 2002 drew that line. They said, by virtue of the nature of impeachment evidence, the vagaries of defense strategy and placements, impeachment evidence would not come within the Brady rule for a plea. But anything that gets them off the hook, that would come within the contemplation of a pre-plea Brady claim because it's exculpatory. So this case both sets the context for applying Brady in a plea setting and sets the boundaries in which it might apply. So let's just start with the assumption.
I watched those tapes, and I watched the tapes. It took a long time to watch them. They were like in slow motion, or actually they were in fast forward.
Yes.
There were literally hours of tapes, am I correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And to me, they were exculpatory. Do you say they weren't exculpatory? A defense attorney couldn't argue that it showed no crime whatsoever that this man committed?
Let me be clear. It's favorable under Brady because it is exculpatory, but it has to be exculpatory and material. That's the test, materiality. It can't just be favorable.
Well, the state's saying that he molested a child in a swimming pool, and you look at the tapes and it doesn't show him molesting a child in the swimming pool.
I agree.
Why is that not material?
Well, because the crime scene's underwater. What the videotape shows in fast motion, and notwithstanding the quality of the tape, the crime scene is literally a couple of square inches between the legs of a 7-year-old underwater.
What about the reaction of the children that he was tossing in the water? There was no reaction that I saw.
Well, I think that's easily explained, frankly. And Mr. Hubler sows the seeds for the forensic argument because he said, this little girl got no attention at home. She got the attention from me, and that's why she kept coming back. Now, I understand why that's favorable, because it looks like, as the defense attorney said, even though she, you know, none of us have any necessary qualification.
But 12 people have to find him guilty at a trial. 12 people. If anybody has a doubt, that person could either have a hung jury or convince other jurors of not guilty, and this man's facing life imprisonment, is serving life imprisonment.
Absolutely. And, of course, we have the victim's account, which is not contradicted by anything. At least nothing on the videotape is contradictory of what Mr. Hubler's proposed defense would be. His analysis relies on things that I don't think are recognized by the cases. he suggests that the defense strategy in this case would have been different. And by that I mean, and I'm reading between the lines just based on what the defense lawyer said, that she would have thrown herself in front of a car to stop Mr. Huber from pleading guilty. So apparently the emphasis placed on it by Judge Kosach was the approach to the case would have been different had the defense attorney had these tapes. But as I told you before, she wanted to look at these tapes and tried to stall the client. He wasn't interested. That's a factor that has to be weighed in the analysis here for a pre-plea Brady violation. You know, what do we do when the client is not interested in seeing what the lawyer thinks is exculpatory? I have a proposed answer for that, and we can kick that around as we go through here. But his materiality analysis does not really focus on anything relevant. He points out that perhaps the defendant would have pleaded guilty, but we don't know, or would not have pleaded guilty and gone to trial. But there's no evidence to support that from the objective standpoint. The Brady test materiality is a reasonable possibility test in this case, as the three-judge panel pointed out. That's an objective analysis, and we have to look through a number of factors. In the in-bank reconsideration petition, you know, Ms. Tyker and Mr. Huber argued that the court viewed that from the wrong perspective. All of the cases that talk about a pre-plea Brady claim look at factors. And I'll just run through them real quickly and I'll sit down. But what the three-judge panel focused on, and all the cases focus on, are the relative strengths and weaknesses of the state's case or the competitive cases, the persuasiveness of the withheld evidence. Now, I would suggest that tape is neutral to an extent. It's favorable to an extent, but it shows constant contact with the victim and a clear opportunity to commit the crime. So that helps the state. The reason cited by Mr. Huber for pleading, there's no connection to this exculpatory evidence and the decision to plead, which is exactly what happened in the Sturgeon case relied on by the three-judge panel. The benefits of the bargain or benefits of pleading, that's probably a wash, although it's a factor because the state got something and Mr. Huber got something. And then the courts also look at the plea canvas, which is the least persuasive of the five factors, the thorough canvas in this case. So really the case comes down to the factor analysis for materiality, relative strength and weaknesses of the state's case and Huber's case, and the persuasive effect of the withheld evidence. Those are things that Judge Kosach did not even touch. All he talked about is a different strategy. And the question becomes, would Huber have even gone along with that? And we don't know. It's an objective test. So I think under de novo review, the court should reverse Judge Kosach's ruling under all these factors. Thank you.
May it please the court, Lori Tyker appearing on behalf of the respondent, Mr. Charles Huber. This is not a case of an evil 60-year-old man who preys on children. Mr. Huber is a Vietnam vet who endured traumatic experiences while serving his country when he was ordered by superiors to kill children. He tried to get help with PTSD and the post-traumatic stress that he suffers from. But the VA and anyone else that he tried to talk about it dismissed it, including the investigating detective in this case when you take a look at the interrogation and his brand new public defender lawyer who was appointed to represent him. As a result, Mr. Huber overcompensated by befriending children. Mr. Huber also suffers from debilitating and significant medical conditions that cause, along with other symptoms, tremors. Again, something important when you take a look at the tapes as you have Justice Cherry and think about the alleged touching that occurred underwater. The state admits that they didn't disclose, even with specific requests by counsel. Counsel testified in the evidentiary hearing that she had asked for this information. This information was talked about in the police reports that she was given. She was given police reports. The paragraph that summarizes the interrogation of Mr. Huber says at the bottom, see transcript of tape for further details. That tape was never transcribed. We got a hold of that tape after a federal court order asking for discovery, and we had it transcribed. When we watched that tape and realized that what was said, what was stated as a summary by this detective, was very different than what Mr. Hubler was actually saying. He did. What this court needs to understand, and I know has read all of the records and understand the totality of the circumstances in this situation. Mr. Hubler was extremely depressed after he was arrested. The last thing, and he says over and over in the interrogation, the last thing that he wants to do. He did not allow her to get the tapes. He said he wanted to plead guilty. He is still entitled to an effective representation. And just because he said that he wanted to plead guilty doesn't mean that that stops her responsibility. But it's intertwined, and you can't, in terms of the Brady and what happens with the Brady, the ineffective assistance of counsel can't excuse the fact that the state withheld this evidence. Because she didn't get those tapes, that doesn't mean that, correct, on several occasions. I'm sorry? No, they did. Their general discovery order, they entered in a general discovery order, and then on several occasions she followed up with the DA and said, I need the tapes, I want the tapes. They were never turned over. So it's a specific and a general request. It came very quickly, but that doesn't excuse the state from turning over exculpatory evidence. That's absolutely no excuse. The state is under a burden pursuant to U.S. Supreme Court case law and case law in the state of Nevada that they have a continuing duty to disclose the evidence, even up until he's sentenced.
Ms. Tiger, if I could interrupt you. Generally, when a criminal defendant pleads guilty and then asks to have their guilty plea withdrawn, we expect the defendant to indicate to the court that I wouldn't have pled guilty had I known the true facts. In this case, Mr. Hubler told his lawyer, I want to plead guilty, and the lawyer objected at that time, both because of its early stage and because of the nature of the charges. But over the lawyer's objection, Mr. Hubler pled guilty. Then when it came time for this hearing, when the tapes are now discovered, the lawyer tells the court, I would have objected to him pleading guilty. But at no time does Mr. Hubler tell the court, I would not have pled guilty had I known about these tapes and had I seen these tapes. Why should this court ignore our approach to post-conviction review when the defendant, who pled guilty initially, got a benefit because other charges were eliminated, and now once again does not indicate he would not have pled guilty even when the tapes are now known?
First of all, under Sanchez, it's an objective standard. It's also an objective standard under Hill versus Lockhart. Mr. Hubler doesn't have to say that he wouldn't have pled guilty. It's an objective standard that under a de novo review, this court needs to look at. The counsel has a constitutional obligation to be effective and to represent him zealously. And counsel said that had she had this information, she had a situation where she's representing a client who's suicidal. He tried to hang himself in the jail. He's despondent. He's depressed. he wants to plead guilty and just get it over with. You have a situation where counsel is faced with a police report that states that he made admissions and he said that he confessed to this crime. She's not given the police surveillance video. What is she supposed to do? She has no idea that this evidence exists. So she goes forward and goes forward with the plea, accepts the plea. It's an objective standard, and just because Mr. Hubler didn't testify and said that he would not have pled guilty does not mean that he's not entitled to this relief under Brady.
Mr. Hattelstedt indicates that the tapes regarding the swimming pool incident are not exculpatory in nature, or at least not. Could you provide your analysis on the same point?
There's absolutely no way that these police surveillance or the pool surveillance tapes are not exculpatory. The district court looked at the tapes. I know, Justice Cherry, you mentioned that you reviewed the tapes. I'd implore that each and every one of you look at all of these tapes. If you look at the tapes, what you see is exactly what Justice Cherry mentioned. You see a man in a swimming pool. You see lots of adults, lots of kids. Kids are coming and going. Kids are walking past the pool area. You see what every other swimming pool has to offer when kids and grown-ups are playing in a pool. You see girls, boys, the girl at issue, her brother, other children swimming around. You see them climbing on Mr. Hubler's back. You see him picking up and tossing him, picking her up and tossing him. You see him climbing on the back. You see people coming and going. You see this girl going to her parents. She's happy. There's absolutely nothing in this tape that is inculpatory, and it's completely exculpatory to the fact that the defense counsel, when she looked at those tapes, said that there's absolutely no way that he should have pled guilty to this because nothing happened. You say that Mr. Hattelstedt and the state says over and over, the touching happened underwater, the touching happened underwater. Again, I implore that you look at the tapes. You look at the fact that Mr. Hubler is suffering from Parkinson's, he has tremors, he says, and that's why the interrogation tapes are so important as well, because while you have these two conversations that are going along that there's obviously no meeting of the minds that are going on, he says over and over and over again, if I touched her, I didn't know I was touching her in her crotch area. She was climbing on me, I was picking her up, I was pushing her away. She was climbing on me, I was picking her up, I was pushing her away. If anything happened, I didn't know I was doing anything wrong. In terms of the state saying, the other part of the offense obviously is the touching. So we have Mr. Hubler who's admitting that if he did, he touched her. It was by accident, and it certainly wasn't for the mens rea of this offense, which is the intent of arousing his sexual desires. He also says within this interrogation tape, which again is why the video is especially compelling along with the written words that we had transcribed, he says, I don't get aroused, period. I'm a 60-year-old man. I have horrible physical problems. That's just not, it's not at issue here. And so what's so offensive here, when you have the combination of a brand new public defender who is faced with a client who says, I want to plead guilty, she's not given either of these things in discovery, she's not given them, and then you have a police officer who summarizes that video where he's talking, the police officer says, come on, Mr. Hubler, come on, you know, you like to touch children. You like, come on, just admit it. You don't molest girls, you molest boys. Come on, just admit it. Be real with me. You know, touch with me. And he says, I love kids. Kids, I can't even touch a child because of what happened in Vietnam. And if you want to hear about it, it's not pretty. What I had to do was not pretty. I had to go into a village with a bulldozer, and I saw dead children. It's not pretty, and if you want to talk about it, that's fine. And so then he goes on, the detective takes that from there and says, oh, so you have a good side and a bad side, and does the bad side win sometimes? It has nothing to do with inappropriate touching of a child. It has to do with Mr. Hubler and what he experienced in Vietnam and what he is trying to get this detective to understand. So the discovery, Absolutely. Yes. Let me start with the second question. In terms of the materiality of guilt or innocence versus the materiality versus the Brady, the materiality has to go to the third prong of Brady and whether or not the evidence is material and prejudice ensued. And so the standard under that, and again, because there were specific requests made, the standard is more deferential to Mr. Hubler, is that it's a reasonable possibility that but for the failure to disclose the Brady evidence, the defendant would have refused to plead guilty and would have gone to trial. And there's, you know, Roberts, Jimenez cases before, you know, opinions of this court, as well as Sanchez, talk about that test. Ineffective assistance of counsel versus Brady. Sorry. The ineffective, you have the two claims here, okay? But the ineffective assistance of counsel is not a way out of Brady. And you can have both. And it's not, and if you look at the case that I think it's important for the court to take a look at is Banks to Stretzky in terms of talking about this. You can't hold it against the lawyer for not getting the evidence, which would be ineffective, which is what Mr. Hattelstead is saying. She knew about it, she should have gotten it. Well, okay, they should have disclosed it, number one. But you can't hold it against her and have the ineffective assistance of counsel be the way to get out of the Brady claim. That's not right. Specific requests were made by counsel. And under Banks versus Dredsky, what the court says, and it's very similar to this, you can't rely on the representations of the state that by not holding anything back exculpatory, the defense shouldn't have to scavenge for these things. They should be able to rely on the fact that what they're given is representative of what's there. And that how is she supposed to know, reading this paragraph, that unless she's given the tape, which she's asked for, how is she supposed to know that what he says, Mr. Hubler says, is absolutely not accurate, and it's completely exculpatory and completely material in terms of whether or not she would have recommended to him that he plead guilty. And what you're asking the defendant to realize, thank you, what you're asking the defendant to realize here is that he made an exculpatory non-confession. If you say that that was Mr. Hubler's burden, Mr. Hubler, who's suicidal and has all these problems with PTSD, it's nonsensical when you think about this in terms of Miranda. Miranda's there because interrogations are such a coercive situation. And the point of the interrogation process is the statement is usually one thing that you get in discovery, and here you don't even have that. So you'd expecting Mr. Hubler to be able to say and to distinguish between the mens rea and the act rea, the act in this case, and to be able to say that these interrogation tapes are defaulted to him is just simply nonsensical. In conclusion, yeah. We don't. And so what I would ask of this court is that if you don't reverse and affirm the district court's ruling granting Mr. Hubler relief, that you should at least remand. Remand and ask him to rewrite the order pursuant to 34.810 and numerous published and unpublished cases coming from this court, including Nika and Byford, and make him do it right. Make him have specific, and the state doesn't disagree with that. The state doesn't agree, they don't disagree that the order is not clear the way it's written, there's no findings of facts, there's no conclusions of law. At least, I implore, if you don't uphold Mr. Kosach's order, that you remand it and make him do it again.
Ms. Tyker, is Mr. Hubler out of custody now? Or?
Yes, he is.
Okay, so when the judge granted the writ, did he release him on bail, or what happened?
Yes, he did. Yes, he
okay.
did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Maybe the best thing for me to do is just to ask if there's any questions. I have an answer for your question. Frankly, I'm iffy about it. And when I wrote my answer to the in-bank reconsideration, I basically said, in agreement, they're not enough findings of fact here. The three-judge panel, I would say, it would be fair to say, implied findings and ruled under any standard. It's reversed. I don't know if it's necessary. I leave that to you. I'll just put it that way. I'll leave it in your discretion. If you want more findings, the three-judge panel has already applied both tests, reasonable probability and reasonable possibility, and concluded under either. Neither of these tapes is exculpatory material evidence.
What message do we send to the state? In fact, we say you can violate, you can not provide written statements made or statements made to interrogating officers and tapes of the swimming pool tapes. What message are we sending to you as the district attorney?
If
we say you don't have to do it, you know, no problem, no harm, no foul.
Well, I think all you have to do is cite the ethical standard, and that's all. That standard exists whether you rule in favor of Brady or not.
Brady's a constitutional issue.
Absolutely, and I don't think you send a good message if you just paste this over. As I said before, you have not written on this slate before. This is a case of first impression in this state. There is a split of authority. I think there are more cases, better reasoned cases, that say Brady applies in a plea case. But if I'm in the library and I find that minority view and look at it and say, well, you know, I've got the ethical standard now. But if you write on the slate now and put a standard out there for us, we have it. And as I suggested before, there should be a distinction between material exculpatory evidence, evidence that gets the guy off the hook, and evidence that is material impeachment evidence. That is far more, how can we put it, ambiguous. Its application is not always crystal clear. Some things might be important impeachment evidence, some stuff might not. But I think clearly in a case where you've got exculpatory material evidence, you can write on that slate in this case today and still reverse Judge Kosach.
Could you comment on the materiality of the confession tape?
Exactly.
And the standard that should apply to our review of the withholding of that tape?
Exactly. And the cases, without exception, talk about causation. But for the failure to reveal, the plea would have been not guilty. Every case that touches the subject says that. And as you pointed out, you know, maybe we could conjure up a case where the defendant doesn't testify and we can reach a reasonable possibility. This is the case that needed it, because he told his lawyer, I want to plead guilty. He never said after that, but for this confession, which the police officer grossly and accurately described, which I disagree with, I would have changed my plea to not guilty. I would have rolled the dice on two counts of and two life sentences to listen to the little girl testify in excruciating detail about the digital manipulation of her private parts. Now, you contrast that with these tapes. That's not a reasonable possibility of a different outcome. That's what I respectfully submit to you, Justice Cherry.